Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As promised, Carla Broussard here with us this hour. The number is 888-318-7884. We continue with open forum. And I do, in fact, want to encourage non-Catholics to call. We love talking with everybody about the Catholic faith. We don't hide the fact that we're Catholic and you're going to get the Catholic view. But maybe you're like, why do Catholics do this or think that or believe that? Most especially, maybe there's, even if you're Catholic, maybe there's one of those Catholic doctrines that you're like, what is that Catholic teaching about? What are they talking about with this or that? You're welcome to call 888-318-7884. I can't even, Carlo's got so many books now, I can't even remember all of them.
Come on, man.
I know that he wrote Prepare the Way, Overcoming Obstacles to God, the Gospel, and the Church. I know that he wrote Purgatory is for Real, Good News about the Afterlife, for those who aren't perfect yet. And then he wrote two books.
Speak for yourself, Si.
No, well, for not being perfect yet. Well, Carlo, you have a very high opinion of yourself. I'm glad to hear
it. Off to a bad start today.
With all that said, welcome, Carlo.
Thanks, Si. Thanks for having me, buddy. It's great to be here with you.
We're always grateful when you are here and picking up a little bit of the open forum.
Yeah.
So people can come at you with whatever they got.
Yeah, sure. So rather than doing a topical show, we're kind of opening the table up for a variety of topics that people might have weighing on their hearts and minds.
And they can call. You can call 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. I'm just looking. Okay, I know where to go first. So you out speaking at all, doing anything like that?
Well, I have some speaking engagements coming up in March. I'll be heading out to Greensboro, North Carolina to do a mission over there.
Oh, very nice.
On apologetics in an age of unbelief and relativism and stuff. Get to talk a little bit about my new forthcoming book in a couple of months
right.
The New Relativism, Unmasking the Philosophy of Woke Moralists. I'll be going to Billings, Montana for a gala fundraiser for Catholic Radio over there. I was actually just doing a radio interview this morning in preparation for that event. And I'll be heading to Ireland to continue my doctoral studies Dr. Gavin Kerr at St. Patrick's Pontifical University in Maynooth, Ireland. Shameless plug, if there's anybody out there who's interested in a PhD program, contact Dr. Gavin Kerr.
Did you get some kind of consideration for that, Carla?
Absolutely
10%
not.
Off
it's because
tuition.
I believe in what Dr. Kerr is doing. And so
he's
been very generous in helping me out. I've been having a blast with him. So, yeah. So if I get in trouble, I'll just beg for forgiveness.
Why would you get in trouble?
I don't know. Like, there's these on-air rules that sometimes you got to know. Like, say that or whatever.
Yeah, and you can't take tuition bribes to...
No tuition bribes. Okay. Absolutely.
No, I believe you. I believe you, Carlo.
Absolutely 100% true. Hey, man, I'm a Thomas, and I
know you don't lie.
I don't lie. That's right.
I
at least I try not to lie.
Well, but you're not one of those people who will be like... you don't kind of go, well, there might be situations where you could lie. You're a straight-up Thomist on that.
Yeah, sure.
I'm trying to be convinced.
I'm persuaded of
you're
that
persuaded.
View.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But that's a whole other topic for a whole
Well, maybe it's
show.
Not. Maybe somebody's going to call about that and say, why does the Catholic Church teach you can't lie? 888-318-7888. I didn't even finish the phone number because the first call is from Billings, Montana. Didn't you just say you're going to Billings, Montana?
I did.
Is this a setup as well, Carlo?
It is not.
Really?
It is not. Absolutely
that's
not.
That's two in a row.
In fact, I actually thought when I was taking a peek at the screen here, I was like, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. All right, let me give out the phone number, Grace, and then we'll get to you. 888-318-7884. Grace is in Billings, Montana, listening on Billings Catholic Radio, for whom Carlo works, apparently. Go ahead, Grace, with your question for Carlo.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I am doing a write-up for our parish, and one of the things that I was asked to cover was on fasting, like why we fast and whatnot, and the laws for fasting in our faith for during the Lenten season and whatnot. And so I was also touching on, you know, are you aware of fasting before communion and why we do that? But when I looked up the canon law on that, it had these three little points, and I had never heard that before, that the elderly do not have to. It says the elderly, the infirm, and those who care for them. And I always knew the sick didn't have to. But I when it said the elderly, like, how general is that? What age are they talking about?
Right.
And then I read something on that immense care, I'm not sure how you say it, caritatis? Trinitatis, okay. from the Pope. And it seemed like it was referencing, at that point, more like those who were elderly that were confined to their homes or some type of a nursing home. So I was like, I was never taught that. So I was trying to understand what that was all about.
Okay, well, you can look online at the USCCB and type in, quote-unquote, fast and abstinence. And with regard to the norms on fasting, it states that fasting, which would be Ash Wednesday and Good Friday when fasting and abstinence is obligatory. Of course, Fridays during Lent are obligatory days of abstinence. But with regard to fasting, the obligation is for those from the age of 18 until 59. So post 60 and older and up, they would no longer be obliged by the rule of fasting. With regard to abstinence from meat, it states the norms concerning abstinence from meat are binding upon members of the Latin Catholic Church from age 14 onwards. So notice how there the USCCB doesn't put a specific cap on abstinence from meat for these days of obligation of abstinence, but it does put a cap of age for fasting. And of course, the rationale behind that is because for those 60 and above, they might not be able to limit the amount of food that they take in given the needs of their aging body. But with regard to abstinence, that does not have to do with the amount of food, just a particular type of food that one is obliged to abstain from on the obligatory days of abstinence. Now, we can carve out a space, a hypothetical space of a limited circumstance to where perhaps for a particular individual, they might have some sort of diet that absolutely demands meat in their system, like in their diet, such that if they don't have it, it's going to cause all sorts of physical ailments and complications. In that case, that individual could receive a dispensation and be dispensed from that obligatory precept and would not be guilty of disobedience of the church's precept and, in this case, mortal sin by eating meat on these days of abstinence from meat. With regard to the Code of Canon Law, you were mentioning, just for our listeners' sake, that's Canons 1249 to 1253. Grace, is that helpful to you?
Yes, but my question is about canon law that is with regards to receiving Holy Communion and the fast for that. I kind of understand the other one, but and it's 919, and then it has like point 1, 2, and 3.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I totally I misheard you. My mind latched on the fasting, the fasting part. So you're asking for fasting before Holy Communion.
Right, and it has a section on there where it talks about the elderly, and I was like, well, I'd never heard that before. I always knew if you were sick.
Yeah.
Or if you were in the hospital, that kind of thing, that you didn't have to. But this one actually said the elderly. But when you go by the letter that the Pope wrote at the time, Immense Caritatis, in 1973, and I think he makes a comment, and they list like four.
Okay.
But it still sounded like,
Yeah, Grace, you know, to be honest, with regard to that specific question with fasting or abstinence, abstaining, right, before Holy Communion, the general norm being abstaining from food and drink besides water before receiving Holy Communion, that's the general norm. And I would have to do a little bit more research to get the specifics of what you're referring to because it's just not, I don't have it relevant at hand in my current knowledge. I would have to do a little bit more research on that. But the general principle that one could be dispensed from the precept could apply. Now, with regard to the elderly and what does that mean specifically and the age that would apply to, I don't know off the top of my head right now. I would have to ask around and do a little research for that. Like what's being conceived by elderly here and who that would apply to specifically to where they're no longer bound by that disciplinary precept.
Okay.
Yeah, so sorry I can't be a further help to you right now.
I think it's anyone over 57.
That's okay, thank
you. 57?
Because I'm 58. So I think it's anybody over 57.
I mean, maybe it might very well be. I mean, so think about this, Grace. I'm just spitballing here. You know, with regard to the obligatory days of fasting, that's with regard to the days, age 18 to 59. So it might be, and I emphasize might, because I may be wrong here, it might be that the same age range applies to other types of obligations of fasting, such as fasting 1 hour before receiving Holy Communion. So that would be my initial thought, but I, like I said, I would have to do more research to confirm that or see if I'm off base there.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Grace. All right. Well, sorry I couldn't be of more help for you.
But you know what? But by the time he gets to Billings, Montana next month, I know he's going to have an answer. So you should probably go to the fundraiser for Billings Catholic Radio.
Yeah.
All right, Grace?
Yes.
Okay.
Sounds good. Yes.
Very
thank
good.
You.
All right. Now I should get a kickback. I feel like I should be getting some kind of gratuity now. The number is 888-318-7884. It's open forum, and Carlo Broussard is our guest. Your calls are welcome, but we got to take a break before we take any more of them. We'll do that and be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Your questions, Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
One time somebody said to me, "Why don't you air these people?" And I said, "No, but I don't think they're Catholic." He says, "By what right do you have to say that?" I said, "I own the network."
Mother Angelica Live Classics. Tonight, 8 Eastern on EWTN Television and Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Carlo, our guest, your calls welcome. 888-318-7884. It's an open forum, so whatever your question might be. Got a question about Mary, got a question about the Bible, got a question about the moral teaching of the church. 888-318-7884. Going now to Matt in Illinois, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Matt, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question for Carlo.
Gentlemen, hello. I was just wondering why it takes so long, maybe a year or more, to come into the Catholic Church. And we have biblical examples, you know, the Ethiopian eunuch, the Philippian jailer, even 3,000 people in one verse in the book of Acts come in that very day. So why does it take so long?
Yeah, great question, Matt. Well, my first thought would be this, brother. The citations that you refer to in the New Testament definitely show us that it is permissible and something that can be done for someone to immediately enter into the Catholic faith upon acknowledging the name of Jesus, believing in him, and agreeing to what it means to be a Catholic Christian. So, and we as Catholics, but in no way say, you cannot do that, right? So the Catholic Church allows for, in some circumstances, for some people, when a pastor discerns it is fitting for that individual to come into the Catholic Church in a faster way, as opposed to joining the rite of initiation of for Christian adults and go through the several months process before entering into the faith. So at least for a Catholic, Matt, we would recognize that the citations you refer to and are the ordinary course of events of people going through the RCIA program, that's reconcilable. So, but then we're still left with the question, well, what's the rationale behind taking that time for somebody to go through that journey in order to receive baptism? Well, one answer is that it's pointing back or reconstituting a lived experience of the early church, where post-New Testament age, right in the very beginning of early Christianity, you had the catechumens, those who were preparing to be baptized, going through formation and learning the Christian life and what we to believe as a Christian, what we are to do as a Christian before being baptized. And that took some time. And so the church, modern church today, has reclaimed that ancient practice of going through that time of formation during the season of Lent in preparation for Easter in order to prepare the people to make sure they know what they are getting into, what they are assenting to, the promises or the vows that they're going to be taking, that they need to know what they will be professing. And that's a good thing, right? You, and especially for people who are just, who are coming into the church from no religion at all, say, they need some time to process what the Christian faith is all about, to inquire, to ask those questions, so that when it comes time to be baptized, they can say yes with informed consent. And it also serves the good of rooting the seed, right? Tilling the soil in order that that soil will be nice and ready to receive the seed, so that when the seed flowers, it can remain strong. It's rooted deep in the rich soil, and it's going to be healthy, and it's going to grow, and it's going to flourish, as opposed to the seeds that are dropped on the pathway and picked off by the birds or thrown in the rocky soil when they come up and they wither away. So one rationale behind the RCIA, or even just a pastor sitting with someone for several months to go through an instruction, is to avoid that seed being thrown in the rocky soil, coming up, withering away, or being plucked away by the birds. And so it's all ordered to ensuring to the best of our ability that that person is going to be able to receive the seed of the Word of God in a good way, so that it can root itself deep in the soul and manifest the fruits as it flowers by God's grace. Is that helpful to you, Matt?
Okay, yeah, it just seems like a year is a little excessive. I don't know if you'd agree with that, but I will think on these things. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Matt. Yeah, you know, in the time frame itself, that is something that is of a disciplinary nature, right?
Yeah.
So in the ordinary circumstances, this is the time frame, and Catholics can legitimately have different opinions about the prudence of the time frame, whether it needs to be longer or shorter. And so that's something that would be open for conversation.
I have heard, maybe it'll be a comfort to Matt. There is a broad critique. Lots of people have critiqued the church's practice here in the United States of taking so long.
Right.
So you do see that. But you also see the other side of it, of people who go through the RCIA and then end up not practicing the faith, and
right.
You wonder, well, are we doing enough?
So. And in those cases, sometimes it's not because there's not enough. It's not about the quantity.
Yeah.
It's the quality.
Yeah.
And in some places, there is a lack of quality with regard to the formation. And so you get an unfortunate effect that comes about where the person ends up leaving the faith because of a lack of qualitative formation in the process itself.
Again, thanks, Matt, for the call. I'm going to go to Pedro in Columbus, Ohio, listening on 88.7 FM. Pedro, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Carlo.
Yes, good evening. Thank you for taking my call and question. And it comes from maybe my misunderstanding or lack of understanding the definition, but if Mary was the most pure of all and free of all sin, even natural sin from Adam and Eve, then why did she experience pains at birth on the birth of Jesus Christ? That means that she had pains of labor and all of this. So why did she experience that if she was free of all sin, even natural sin?
Okay, Pedro, fantastic question. And there's a lot on the table here. So bear with me. I'm going to try to untangle a few things and bring some light and some clarity, hopefully. So the first thought that we can get out on the table is that there is no essential and necessary connection between being free from original sin and experiencing labor pains. Is it true that labor pains are an effect or a curse or a temporal punishment due to the original sin of Eve? Yes, that's clear in Genesis. But it doesn't follow from that that if one is free from original sin, then she necessarily must be free from the labor pains. And here's an example. We know that death is also a temporal punishment consequence of the original sin. But it doesn't follow from that that if one is free from original sin, then necessarily they must always live and never die. That's obviously false, right, Pedro? I mean, because our Lord, he was free from original sin, but yet he still died. So his death is not evidence that he had original sin. He can be free from original sin and still die. So at least logically here, Pedro, it's at least logically possible that Mary could be free from original sin and still have labor pains. So labor pains would not in any way be a threat or impinge upon our belief that Mary was free from original sin from the moment of her conception. With that said, it is true, Pedro, that in our church's little t tradition, that would be common teaching, ordinary magisterium of the church, that it's commonly believed that Mary was free from labor pains. So, for example, you have Pope Alexander III in the 12th century writing a personal letter to an Islamic sultan in which he affirms that Mary was free from labor pains, free from pains and giving labor. The Council of Trent Catechism, this would be even a higher level of the magisterium, but not infallible, just what we call the ordinary magisterium. The Council of Trent Catechism affirms in it that Mary gave birth without experiencing any sense of pain. And then we also have the liturgical tradition. There was a Mass celebrated in the Latin Rite before the 1969 reform of the liturgy. The church prayed in that Mass, Mary at the foot of the cross, that she who had given him birth without the pains of childbirth. And I would recommend that you check out on our website, Pedro, at Catholic.com. Our previous guest here, my colleague and our good friend Tim Staples, wrote an article entitled, Was Mary Free from Labor Pain? And he articulates all of these magisterial references. He even appeals to scripture, a couple of scriptural references that some theologians and scholars have looked to as pointing to the possibility of Mary being free from labor pains. And so we can definitely affirm its support of Catholic common teaching, not infallible, but nevertheless ordinary common teaching, that Mary was free from labor pains. And so for us as Catholics, the question becomes, well, what does that demand from us? Must we believe that? Well, we couldn't go around outright denying it in public catechetical teachings and saying Mary did have labor pains. That would not be the right approach, because we have the ordinary magisterium and the liturgical tradition affirming that she was without labor pains. But if someone in the depths of their heart just could not bring themselves to assent to this idea that Mary was free from labor pains for whatever reason, that person, Pedro, would not be guilty of mortal sin there. Like, it wouldn't be grave, serious matter, right? Like it would be if in the depths of my heart, I just can't affirm that Mary was bodily assumed into heaven. Well, if I'm denying that in the depths of my heart, that's grave, serious matter, and with full knowledge and deliberate consent, I'm going to incur mortal guilt, the guilt of mortal sin. But in this case, in this particular teaching, Mary being free from labor pains, if somebody in the depths of his or her heart just can't bring themselves to believe that, they would not be guilty of mortal sin. So those are the various aspects. There's various different facets of this diamond here. So hopefully that's helpful for you, Pedro.
Thanks, Pedro. Thanks very, very much. We don't have to take a break just yet. I guess I can get another caller on before we have to do that. The number here is 888-318-7884. It's open forum, and we go to Joe in San Antonio, Texas, listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. Joe, glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Carlo.
Hey, how y'all doing? Thanks for taking my call. I just had a quick question. So, from what I understand, during the Mass, the bread and wine, through transubstantiation, literally transformed to the blood and the blood and body of Jesus, correct? Mm-hmm. And if so, like, what if you were to, like, look at it, I mean, would it literally, it wouldn't literally be that, correct? And, like, how do I, like, what's the explanation for that?
Yeah, Joe, here we're dealing with things that are going to go beyond what we can empirically verify through the means of modern science, the methods of modern science. Oh, I hear the music there, Joe. So please, buddy, hang on, and we'll try to get to your question on the other side of the break.
I hope you will hang on, Joe. We have two lines open right now, 888-318-7884. Is the Catholic doctrine you'd like better explanation of? We're here for that. Right back with more after this on Catholic Answers Live. The recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade was a monumental victory for the pro-life movement. But the fight is far from over. With our new booklet, Why We're Pro-Life, we have produced the perfect tool to prepare you to have peaceful and convincing conversations to shed light on the truth about human life from conception to natural death. Catholic Answers is printing millions of copies of this booklet, and we plan simply to give them away. You can help us in two ways. First, by generously supporting this project. 25 cents prints one book. $2,500 prints 10,000, and so on. Second, by helping us distribute the booklet through your parish, your school, or the pro-life ministry you work with. Catholic Answers is going to blanket the country with Why We're Pro-Life, but only if you step up and help us. Thank you so much. For more information, visit whyweareprolife.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret, we've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, this is Johnette Williams. We embrace the essence of feminine spirituality on Women of Grace tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Carlo Broussard, our guest this hour. Lots of folks on the line. We'll still be able to get you in if you call now, 888-318-7884. Joe in San Antonio wants to know, really, the science, I suppose, behind the transubstantiation. Yeah.
Joe, are you still with us, buddy?
Joe?
Okay.
Yes, I'm here.
All right, fantastic. All right, awkward silence there on the air, right? Okay, so Joe, yeah, so what I was saying before the break, what we're dealing with here is something that goes beyond what we can empirically verify with the methods of modern science, because we're dealing with reality that just transcends the material physical cosmos. We're talking about substance. We're talking about what the thing is that goes beyond what we see and taste. Within ordinary circumstances, we use our senses, what we see, what we taste, and then we're able to be led in the mind to the reality of what things are, their essence, the very reality of those things. But in this case, we're dealing with something that's called supernatural revelation. Now, we're going to employ the concepts and mental frameworks of philosophy and ways that the great philosophers have tried to articulate this stuff. Like, what is this thing in front of me as a computer? What is this thing on the side of me? That's a human being, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sort of these notions of what things are, the substance of something. And we employ those philosophical concepts to try and explain and shed light on the data of divine revelation. So Jesus taking the bread and the wine and saying, this is my body, this is my blood. So the bottom line, Joe, is, you know, what is changing is not what is subject to being verified by science. What is changing is that which we can only know through philosophical reasoning, which goes beyond what we can verify with the methods of modern science, such as the very substance of the thing, the reality of what that thing is. And we are affirming, we profess and believe, based on divine revelation, that the very substance, the reality, the whatness of bread completely ceases to exist and turns into changes. And there is present now the very substance, the very reality of Jesus' body. And of course, with the wine, the substance or the whatness of wine changes into the very reality of Jesus' blood. So think about this, Joe. Let's use the wedding feast at Cana as an analogy where Jesus changes water into wine. So in that case, what you have changing is the very whatness, the substance, the reality. It was water, then it was wine. But what you also have changing in that miracle is the things about water and the things about wine that are subject to scientific verification, those things also change too. So the liquidness, right? The taste, the smell, the effects that these things are going to have on us in our bodies. In the miracle of the wedding of Cana, those things change too. But in the, and I use this term in a very loose way for all my friends out there listening, theological friends. In the miracle, quote unquote, miracle of the Eucharist here in the sacrament, what you have changing is the substance, like in the miracle of wedding of Cana, water into wine, in this case, wine into Jesus' blood. But unlike in the miracle of Cana, what you have here in the Eucharist is those things about bread and wine that are subject to scientific verification and what we perceive with our senses, those things remain the same. And that is only due to divine power. Only God, by his divine power, can sustain in being, right? Can hold in existence those very qualities of bread and wine that are subject to being verified through the methods of modern science. And so if we're restricted in a worldview of the only thing that exists is matter, and the only tools that we can use to know what's real is the methods of modern science, you will not be able to come to the conclusion that this is Jesus' body and blood. Science will not get you there. It's the wrong vehicle, buddy, to hop in order to get to the destination. Not even our own pure philosophical reasoning will lead us to the conclusion that Jesus' body and blood is there. We can only rely on Jesus' testimony and divine revelation there. But once we have that divine revelation, then we can use the philosophy to begin making sense of this stuff. Like, yeah, bread's no longer there. Jesus is entirely there. Just whatever is subject to our senses, that's remaining by divine power. What do you think of that, Joe?
That completely answers my question.
Thank you very much. Oh, fantastic. Thanks for calling with the question. It was great.
Rarely do we get that completely answers my question. That is such a...
I love that analogy that you gave. So, I completely understand what you're saying.
Thanks,
Definitely,
Joe.
Thank you for answering my question.
All right, you're welcome, buddy.
Joe, I appreciate that.
Send that one to the boss, man. Yeah. Send that one to the boss.
Yeah, we're keeping that tape, but... Well, it's not tape anymore, but you know what I'm talking about. But Joe, hang on the line, and Carlo will ask you which one of – I mean, Edgar will ask you which one of Carlo's books you want, and we'll send you a free book because 100% satisfaction is very high. That's very high.
We'll take it.
I'm going to give you a question from YouTube.
All right.
Because I've been visiting with the folks over at YouTube. And
you haven't been paying attention to what I'm saying. You're actually doing things on the side. Come on, I thought you cared about
Wait a second. So you think when I'm like just sitting here and nodding my head that I am paying attention because I have mastered that technique. Good point, Carlo.
You're a multitasker, huh?
Well, I'm...
You're just not listening to me.
I have accomplished some things. All right, so this comes from someone on YouTube. I think you get to make up your own name because I don't think his parents named him this. It's Mr. Me 123. I don't think that. Do you think his parents named him that? Mr. Me 123 wants to know this: are punishments and purifications different in purgatory for unconfessed or forgiven venial sins versus the residual effect left by sin that also needs to be purified? You're going to have to tell me what the question means because I don't even know that.
So as I understand it, I think what they're trying to get at is, okay, you got these remnants of sin. One is the guilt of sin. Now, for any soul in purgatory, they're not going to have the guilt of mortal sin because that leads to hell, so it's going to be the guilt of venial sin. So if there's guilt of venial sin remaining on the soul, the person dies, well, that guilt of venial sin has got to get purified, right? But there's these other remnants of sin that the church identifies, like unhealthy attachments to created goods.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Where there's sort of a rootedness of the disorder of the will being inclined to that creaturely good in a disordered manner. Or the debt of temporary punishment due for those past forgiven sins. So I think the question is, you know, will the suffering that comes about as a result of the purification be more intense for these other remnants of sin, unhealthy attachment to creaturely goods and debt of temporal punishment, than the purification of the guilt of venial sin? The first thing to say in response is the church has no definitive statement answering this question. So we're within the realm of speculative theology here.
Okay, but you wrote a book on purgatory.
I did write a book on purgatory.
So speculate away.
Speculate away. And based upon the theological tradition and speculation of great theologians, many would say, and this seems persuasive and reasonable to me personally, that the purification of the unhealthy attachments and the discharging of the debt of temporal punishment due for sin would be more intense for the soul than the mere purification of the guilt of venial sin. So I would be inclined to go with that view until proven otherwise. You know, I'm sure there's other argumentation out there to the contrary, but that seems reasonable to me. You know, Aquinas points this out when he's talking about the intensity of suffering in the final purification that we call purgatory, that, for example, the more deeply rooted an unhealthy attachment to a creaturely good is within the soul, the more intense the suffering will be when being finally purified of that unhealthy attachment. The more debt, or perhaps of temporal punishment due for past forgiven sin, a more serious sin is going to be proportionate to a greater degree of debt of temporal punishment, and even severity, you might say, of temporal punishment due for that past forgiven grave sin, as opposed to a debt of temporal punishment for a past forgiven venial sin. So one could make the argument that there's going to be a proportion between the gravity of the sin and the debt of the severity of the temporal punishment that's due for that forgiven sin.
Yeah.
Right? Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense.
So
try not to sin so much. That's what I'm getting out of this.
When you take all of that into consideration, it seems reasonable to me that suffering would be more intense for the soul, for some souls who have unhealthy attachments to creaturely goods that are more deeply rooted, or more severity of temporal punishment due for our grave sins, as opposed to just the guilt of venial sin being remitted.
Got it. Mr. Me 123, I don't believe that's your real name, but I'm glad we got your question on. Thank you very much for the question. We got lots more calls, but we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
providing quality programming faithful to the teachings of the Catholic Church, EWTN is television that viewers can trust. Whether it's films, documentaries, news coverage, lively discussion shows, or kids' programs, we highlight the truth that is the eternal word. For a complete schedule of EWTN television programs, visit EWTN.com and click TV. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Having a very, very nice hour with Carlo Broussard, our guest. And you are welcome to call. I think, yeah, we'll still get you on if you call right now. 888-318-7884. There are several folks on the line, though, so off we go back to the phones. If that's all right with you, Carlo.
Let's do it.
Are we going to numero three, line three?
Yes, sir.
All right, Mike in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, watching on Facebook. Glad to have you with us, Mike. Go ahead with your question for Carlo.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question involves 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 8 through 15, and in particular, verses 11 and 12. I'm having a debate with a Protestant friend of mine who came to me asking why he sees so many women teaching in the Catholic Church. And so he tries to cite this to say, well, St. Paul was very explicit that there's this ban on women categorically, not just in the preaching ministry in his faith tradition, but also in any teaching ministry. Of course, I pointed him to, you know, Galatians 3:28, where St. Paul affirms the equal dignity of men and women in Christ.
Yeah.
1 Corinthians 11:5, where women can pray and prophesy otherwise within Christian worship.
There you go.
Certainly in Titus, where women provide an important service in teaching the faith in word and deed and in other contexts. So I try to point him to those things, but he's pretty convinced that 1 Timothy 2 has a particular categorical ban on women's preaching and also teaching ministry. I just wanted to understand better what the church's teaching is.
Okay, yeah, fantastic question, Mike. And in fact, Cy, maybe we can send Mike my book, Prepare the Way.
Okay.
I have one of the chapters deals specifically with this objection. So, Mike, what I'll do here is just kind of summarize the twofold response to this sort of question. And then whenever you get the book, you can read it and get more of the details and the citations and the references, etc. But I'm glad you mentioned 1 Corinthians 11:5, because there Paul is very clear that women could pray and prophesy in church. That's some pretty serious stuff, like prophesying in church.
Right.
So clearly in 1 Timothy 2:11 through 12, where Paul is saying that women need to learn silence and all submissiveness, and the context being within church, he does not mean they cannot speak whatsoever. Now, I understand that this objection is with regard to the teaching aspect. So the question becomes, is Paul forbidding women to have any sort of teaching ministry within the church? And also another question would be, well, maybe there's room for teaching in women within the church, but maybe the more restricted realm of the liturgy. So those would be more important questions to be asking here. So we can look, first of all, Mike, to the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith in 1976 and its document Inter Insigniores on the ordination of men only and the exclusion of women to the priesthood. The document, the CDF, deals with this very question and these biblical texts, 1 Corinthians 14, 34-35 being another text similar to 1 Timothy 2, 11-12. And there, Mike, the CDF provides a plausible interpretation of this as Paul is saying women were not allowed to give official instruction within the Christian assembly. So notice there, we would want to draw a distinction between teaching in a general way and official teaching, like in the homily, say, within the liturgical assembly. So Paul speaks of teaching, but that's a bit ambiguous as to precisely which kind of teaching he's referring to. And so here would be the apologetical import here, Mike. Given the ambiguity as to the precise nature of the teaching, whether official or unofficial, one could not appeal to this text in and of itself as proof positive evidence that the Catholic Church is wrong for allowing women to do some sort of teaching ministry within the church. And even within the liturgical assembly, as far as reading the liturgy of the word. I mean, there's no official teaching going on, but hey, when you read the gospel, that's some kind of teaching going on, right? So the ambiguity as to the precise nature of the teaching could diffuse the challenge being posed to us by our Protestant friends. And then a second plausible interpretation that I explain in this chapter in my book is that it could be that Paul is trying to address a specific problem that arose within the Church of Corinth involving women. So notice how Paul gives this. That would be speaking with regard to the Corinthian church, but the same line of reasoning would apply to Paul's instruction to Timothy as well, right? And whenever he's writing to the church of Corinth, he writes, if there is anything they, the women, desire to know, let them ask their husbands at home. Now, if you read that, which is within the context of Paul telling the women in the Corinth church to be silent in the church, that seems to imply that there was a problem arising where women within the liturgical assembly at church kept asking all these questions. And Paul is saying, ladies, you're assuming here, your questions are good and valid, but save your questions for at home. Mm-hmm. The questions are not appropriate and fitting for what's going on within the liturgical context. And given that that was a problem, for apparently, seemingly a problem that was within the Church of Corinth, that could very well provide a plausible explanation as to why Paul gives this same kind of instruction to Timothy, the young bishop. Hey, Timothy, we know we've had our problems in the Church of Corinth, and you're going to be overseeing local churches, and so this problem may very well arise in your local communities as well, and so here's the instruction. Basically, if there's any women asking questions within the liturgical assembly, like that's going on in the Church of Corinth, well then, make sure and tell them, remain silent, save your questions for them. When you get home, you can ask your husband. So that's another plausible explanation. And notice, Si, on neither of these explanations, or on either of these explanations do we have, neither of these explanations entail some sort of negative view toward women. It's having to do with proper practice of worship and liturgy. And Paul is giving guidelines for that liturgy that just so happens in these contexts to involve women. If it's the official capacity, that's the man's job because it's a male-only priesthood. If it's this other situation of questions being asked, Paul is trying to bring order to the liturgical community, which would fit with what Paul says elsewhere in 1 Corinthians 14, if we're talking about the Church of Corinth, about speaking in tongues. Paul's trying to bring order to that within the church assembly
as well.
They need
to calm down and celebrate the liturgy.
So apparently there was a lot of stuff going on that Paul's having to deal with, and he's just simply transferring that wisdom and knowledge to the young Bishop Timothy as he moves forward in his bishopric.
Mike, what do you think?
I would give that a 99.9.
Really? Because if you had given him 100, I was going to give you a free book, but 99.9 is good, so we'll take that. That's fine.
You already promised the book. I look forward to reading it.
Okay. Thanks, oh, that's Mike. Right. He already had his book.
Okay.
All right. It does seem to me that Paul is quite open to men and women as partners in his ministry.
Absolutely.
As an apostle. I was thinking about Priscilla and Aquila, like in the book of Acts. It doesn't say like Aquila took Apollos aside. It says they both took him aside and they explained to him the faith. So you get the, I mean, I don't know. I was thinking about that when you were talking, that Paul does not seem at all concerned that women shouldn't be joining in this ministry of sharing the good news.
Right. It's only if we follow inter and signioris there, it would be within the boundaries of official capacities of ministry that belongs particularly to the male-only priesthood.
Okay, I hope Mike's getting his book right now. But thank you, Mike. Let's go to Sue in Columbus, Ohio, listening on 8:20 a.m. Sue, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Carlo.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I am walking with an RCIA candidate and who is having a little bit of challenge with the fact that missing Sunday Mass is a mortal sin.
Mm.
And I'm, you know, was trying to explain how Sunday is important. It's the day of the Lord's resurrection. If you have a schedule conflict, you can go to the vigil Mass on Saturday.
Right.
And why would you want to miss any? But she also mentioned, well, you could go to Mass every day of the week.
Mm-hmm.
So why Sunday?
All right.
So I was just wondering what else maybe I could share with her.
Okay. Well, there's several different issues here that I think we can begin untangling and sort of lay the cards out on the table. So one thing is the issue of authority. So if the question is, whence does the church have this authority to say these things and make these precepts, right, and give us these disciplinary laws? If that's the question, well, then we could answer that in saying, well, the church gave Peter and the apostles the authority to bind and loose. That's in Matthew 16, 19, Matthew 18, 18. And that authority involves the authority to make disciplinary laws for the people of God here on earth. Just like Moses and all of the religious leaders for the people of God throughout the Old Testament, making disciplinary laws for the people of God to follow, sacrifice this, don't eat that. And the people of God had to follow those laws because those religious leaders had legitimate authority from God to govern them in their life as the people of God. So if the apostles or the new religious leaders of God's covenantal people here on earth in the new covenant, and they have this authority to bind and loose, they have the authority to make these laws to govern God's people here on earth. And so that would be one issue, the authority issue. Now, with regard to, you mentioned she was struggling with it being a mortal sin. I mean, come on, man, right? What's the deal here? Well, first of all, to miss Mass with full knowledge on Sunday, Sunday Mass, Sunday obligation, with full knowledge and deliberate consent, that's an act of disobedience to the church. But because this discipline involves the greatest thing that we can do, not only as Catholic Christians, but as a human being, is to worship the living God in the highest form of worship, the holy sacrifice of the Mass, the disobedient action takes on a grave matter. It becomes grave and serious to disobey the church in this particular, I mean, disobeying the church is something that we ought not to do ever, right? But in this particular circumstance, it's going to be grave matter. It's going to be grave, serious thing because of the gravity of the situation. Namely, we're disobeying the church, telling us to go and do the most important thing that we can possibly do as a human being and as a Catholic Christian and worship the Almighty God by offering the sacrifice of the Mass in union with the priest. So that would be a way, Sue, that we can begin to explain to someone with regard about the gravity of the issue. Like, why is it so serious, man, that if I intentionally miss Mass on Sunday, I incur the guilt of mortal sin? That would be the answer. And finally, the last issue that seemingly was laid out on the table was why Sunday? Well, the reason why it's Sunday, the rationale, like, why does the church say Sunday and not some other day? Well, because that's the day of the resurrection. It is the day when our Lord rose from the dead, and the early Christians from the very get-go started gathering together to break bread. That's the label that the New Testament authors use, which is a reference to the Eucharist, to listen to the memoirs of the apostles. That would be like the Word of God and listening to the Scriptures. And they did all of these things on Sunday, the first day of the week in the Jewish system, and what is also referred to as the eighth day, the day of the new creation. And so the church, by virtue of her authority, Sue, would eventually put her stamp of approval on that day and say, okay, Catholics, you got to start going to Mass on this day, and it's obligatory.
Now I feel like Tim Staples. I'm really surprised that the hour is over. That was a great hour, Carla. Thanks.
Thank you, Si. Sue, I appreciate it, man. It was fun.
Thank you for the call and the question, Sue. Sorry for anybody that we didn't get to, but we'll be back doing this again tomorrow. Check out all of Carlo's books over at shop.catholic.com. And if you'd like to have Carlo come as a speaker, as they are up in Montana, in Billings, Montana, just go to CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com and look up Carlo and have him come. CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com. That'll do it for us. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.